welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Thursday, June 6th. My name is Rob Dosser. I have a fun show on the way for you today. I was joined by my buddy from CBS Sports, Gary Parrish, and we talked through a whole bunch of different topics, from the NBA draft to kids peeing in our backyards to what to expect from the Memphis Tigers' basketball season. And as always, it is an entertaining listen. I think you're going to enjoy it. If you do, I got to make the usual ask. Please rate, please review, please subscribe to this podcast in any app that you listen to podcasts in. It helps us in the rankings. It helps us in the metrics. Things like that, it makes my bosses happy. When my bosses are happy, I'm happy. And when I'm happy, you are getting a better show. So really, you are just doing yourself a favor by giving me 5 stars and saying nice things about me in the ratings and the reviews. I thank you for any help. Now let's get into that conversation with Gary Parrish. And now let me welcome back onto the podcast CBS Sports columnist, radio host, and I guess the podcast host as well, and the most tortured Mets fan in the history of baseball fandom, one Mr. Gary Parrish. GP, what's going on, man? How you doing?
I'm all right. What's up? You all right?
Yeah, I'm doing all right, man. I'm doing all right. I am I'm going to open up the floor for you to tell me that I am an idiot for my takes on Memphis at the end of this podcast. So I'm teasing that for people to keep them around for a little while. But part of the reason I have you on here is because I wanted to talk a little bit about underclassmen leaving for the NBA and how it affects college basketball in the big picture. I was trying to get Matt Norlander on here because he wrote a column about it the same day that I wrote the column. But, you know, he is off in New York City pretending to be a reporter doing a job at the end, the corruption trials, I guess, with Book Richardson and Tony Bland. So I'm going to have to settle for you, my man.
It's weird that your second pick would be the superior guess, but however you got to go about doing it, it's fine with me.
I was just doing it by height, to be honest with you.
Okay, that makes sense then.
So for people that don't know, in this year's draft class, I think the total ended up being, 86 underclassmen that stayed in the draft, with eligibility still remaining. A year after, there were 79, and then 64 in 2017 and 59 in 2016. I don't think I need to really explain this, but there's 60 picks in the NBA draft, and probably 45 of them that are going to go to American basketball players, 45 or 50 of them. And you don't have to be a mathematical genius to figure out that those numbers don't quite add up. So let me just set you up with this, GP. Is this something that you think we have to be worried about long term when it comes to college basketball and the future of the sport? Because I kind of think that this is the thing that we have to be worried about.
It is something that does impact the sport in undeniable ways. And I'll add to what you said. Obviously, some international players are going to take up some of those 60 spots that 88 underclassmen, or at least theoretically 86, whatever the number is, aiming for. In addition to that, some of these picks are going to be seniors. And so they're just you got a numbers problem. Now, I don't think that all 80-plus underclassmen who are in the draft are going in thinking they're going to get drafted. Some are just ready to be done with school and pursue a professional career in whatever form. And, you know, I wish them luck. I don't fault them as long as they're realistic about what is realistic for them. But I will say, it used to be a deal where if you were a fan of a school, if your favorite team had a player who was projected to be a first-round pick, you could reasonably expect to lose him, although some of them would come back. Blake Griffin was a sophomore, for crying out loud, and that wasn't too long ago. Then it sort of shifted to if you were a fan of a school whose team had a top 45, top 50 prospect, you could reasonably expect to lose them, because it became established that those second-round picks are, quote, guaranteed nothing. College players who were second-round picks were almost without exception getting guaranteed contracts in some form. And now it's shifted to almost nobody who's a projected first-round pick is coming back. And if you've got a top 80 prospect, you might lose him. I think Michigan is the best example of this this year. Michigan, everybody on that roster that secured a number 2 seed in the NCAA tournament had eligibility left, every single player. And they lost 3 players early to professional basketball, even though none of them are going to be first-round picks, and none of them are even on the top 50 of our friend Sam Vecenie's big board over at The Athletic. So they lost three sub-50 prospects. It's really the difference between them being maybe number one in the country preseason and not being ranked at all in the preseason. Of course, I do think that, you know, that had something to do, at least played some role, in John Beilein leaving Michigan to be the Cavs head coach. And so it's affected and impacted Michigan, but also all over the country. I mean, you know, Virginia's losing Kyle Guy. He's not going to get drafted probably. Auburn's losing Jared Harper. I don't know that he's going to get drafted. I mean, these are players who, you know, could really be the difference between a Final Four or something less than that, a national championship or something less than that. And, you know, like I said, it's clearly impacting the sport. Player retention is a real problem now. It's been a problem for a while, but it's a bigger problem, I think, than it's ever been.
Yeah, and I think the best example of this is one of your little homies from Memphis, GP, Dedrick Lawson at Kansas. You know, I don't think that he's going to – if he ends up being drafted, he's probably going to be a second-round pick. At best, I don't even know if he's going to end up doing that. And, you know, if he had returned to Kansas, I think that he is kind of he's that perfect four in the system that Bill Self wants to run. He can be that kind of Marcus Morris kind of player. And, you know, missing him is something that keeps them from being – you know, if he's back, then they're preseason number one. And I think that's pretty – even without Quentin Grimes, I think that that's a pretty easy decision to make.
If he's back, they're probably preseason number one. He might be preseason national player of the year, depending on what you think of Cassius Winston at Michigan State. And you're exactly right. If he does get picked, it'll be in the second round. I think with Dedrick, I believe he might be graduating, though. He's very close to graduating because, remember, he had the sit-out year. So that plays a role. And then I think more than that, he just sort of concluded, probably accurately, there's nothing he can do to become a lottery pick. There's not, you know, whatever he, the NBA teams, whatever you like about him, that's there already, and whatever you don't like about him, the hesitation you might have to drafting him, he's not going to be able to resolve that. He's not going to start playing above the rim next season. He's not going to shoot 48% from 3-point range next season. He is what he is. What he is an awesome college basketball player who I do think can be a pro NBA player, but there's nothing he's really going to be able to do over the next year to improve his stock. And so often these days, you know, college prospects aren't interested in maximizing college careers. They're just, can I improve my stock? No. And then it's time to go. And I think that's what Dedrick is doing. It's just a difference in mindset to where it was 10 years, 20 years ago. And I don't want to be the guy in his 40s screaming about yesterday. But 30 years ago, 20 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, you would not have lost a Dedrick Lawson. But now you almost always will.
And I think there's a very real reason for that. I was having a conversation with an NBA agent last week after I wrote what I wrote. And one of the points that he made is, and I think it's really valid, is that these guys basically have what, like at most a 10-year window to be able to earn off of their athletic ability. Like Dedrick Lawson is what? He's almost 22 years old now. He's probably not going to be playing basketball too long past the age of 32. And if he comes back to Kansas next season, that's 10% of his lifetime earnings off of being a basketball player. And that is a lot of money to ask somebody to give up, 10% of what could end up being their career earnings, to return to school where they're not going to be able to legally make any money off of what they're doing. And this is kind of like a different conversation, but I'm curious how you feel about this. The point in what I wrote was that I think that opening up, you know, we're talking about the NCAA is talking about potentially allowing some players to be able to have access to their name, image, and likeness rights and be able to make money off of that. And I think if you want to be able to avoid situations like Dedrick Lawson leaving early, or, you know, I think another example, I know there were some mitigating circumstances that might have forced Rajon Tucker's hand, but Rajon Tucker, I think, is another perfect example of a guy that maybe could have been convinced to come back for another season had he had the opportunity to be able to profit a little bit off of his name and off of his likeness. Because I can imagine there are people around Lawrence, Kansas, and people around the Memphis program that would have found a way to offer him something comparable for what he can earn. Like, let's say that neither of those guys end up being second-round picks. I did a study a couple years ago that said if you're picked in the top 50, you're more or less guaranteed to get at least – or you've more. Everyone picked in the top 50 in the last, I think it was the last three drafts, has gotten at least 1 year of guaranteed money from the NBA. And I think half of the people that didn't, that were American players that were drafted, got either some form of two-way contract or a G League deal that had them called up to the NBA at some point. So whatever it ends up being, guys like Dedrick Lawson, guys like Rajon Tucker, if they're not a top 50 pick, are probably going to end up having to go to the G League, or probably going to end up having to go overseas, and aren't going to be able to make that much money. So my idea is, when you allow them to get their name, image, likeness, whatever, be able to get sponsorships, be able to be promoted on billboards, be able to get paid for signatures or pictures that are taken or anything like that, that creates a revenue stream for them to be able to make money that would be somewhat comparable to what they could make overseas or what they can make in the G League. And even if you're getting half of whatever your offer would be to go to like Slovenia to be on a team, I just wonder if that might be enough to keep somebody like a Dedrick Lawson or a Rajon Tucker or, you know, a Martin Kramjohl at Creighton, or somebody like an Amir Coffey at Minnesota. Those are difference-making players for their college teams that would, in theory, be able to make some money off of their basketball skills to keep them around college for a year or more. And I think that having those guys like that, correct me if I'm wrong here, but those are guys that could change the fortunes of some of the biggest brands in college basketball. And that is what makes the sport relevant, right?
Well, there's no question. And this is something I've been talking about, writing about, literally for years. Like, you could, you know, allow players to take fair market value for their image and likeness, whatever that is. And I don't mean just basketball players, volleyball players, softball players, soccer players. Doesn't matter to me. Open it up to everybody. Some will get nothing more than they already get. Some will get a little. Some would get a lot. And I know what the counter argument to this is, right? You and I say, do this, what you just described. And the counter argument is, but then what would happen is it would become a recruiting tool, which, of course it would. That's what we're advocating. It would become a recruiting tool and a retaining tool. It would allow, yeah, Nike to spend big money to place people like Zion Williamson and Marvin Bagley at Duke, or Anthony Davis and Carl Anthony Towns at Kentucky. But on a local level, it would allow, you know, schools to, you know, use car lots and local banks and anything else to recruit whatever level, you know, at whatever level they want, to whatever they desire. And so what would happen? The schools with the most intense boosters and the biggest fan bases would have recruiting advantages and retaining advantages over everybody else. Well, guess what? That's the way it already is. Yes, FedEx would step up and tell, in theory, Rajon Tucker, listen, we know that you can probably get a two-way contract worth maybe up to nearly $400,000. But what if we gave you $400,000 to be on a billboard near the airport? Will you stay? Will you enroll at Memphis then? So then guess what? Memphis would have an advantage over, say, UAB when it comes to recruiting players and retaining players. Guess what? Memphis already has an advantage. Bottom line, and I've said this forever, and nobody will ever convince me otherwise, the same schools that get the best players now would get the best players then. Players would get what it is the open market says they're worth, and you would have less turnover in college basketball year over year, because there would be a reason to turn down the money you could get by being a professional. You would get similar money, if not more money, by being a quote-unquote amateur, according to the NCAA's guidelines. To me, we will always get there at some point. It's just a matter of how long is it going to take us to get there.
Yeah, and I honestly, like, I'm not even worried about Nike or Adidas or schools like that necessarily having as big of an influence as some people might imagine, because of the players that they are going to be the most interested in by 2022, in all likelihood, are going to be going straight to the NBA, right? In 3 years' time, like, we're not going to get Zion Williamson in college. And I don't necessarily think that is a huge worry for college basketball moving forward. But, like, look, as much fun as it was to watch Zion Williamson play this year, and as much fun as I enjoyed watching, you know, Jahlil Okafor and that team carry Duke to a national title, and seeing Anthony Davis on a college campus, those things are, you know, I get paid to watch college basketball every night during the season. So if I'm watching a higher level of basketball and some of these stars, like, that's a good thing for me. But in the big picture, where I think that college basketball is getting hurt is you mentioned it earlier, the roster continuity, right? For you to become attached to a team, you need to know the players. Like, you're not going to be able to. The reason I fell in love with UConn when I was growing up is because I watched Ray Allen grow from being some freshman that no one had ever heard of from Texas to turning into an All-American player, and then seeing him make that shot to beat Georgetown in the Big East tournament title game when I was 11 years old. Like, that's still one of my favorite sports memories as a fan growing up. And I don't know if I would have gotten to that point if I hadn't watched Ray Allen over 3 years. You know, you don't. The reason that you love a team is because you feel, for whatever way, some kind of bond with the players on that roster, right? Does that make sense? And losing these guys that are sophomores and juniors and seniors that we may never hear of again in the professional basketball ranks, that you're losing fans that are going to fall in love with those teams because they fall in love with watching those players grow and develop over time. And being able to keep those guys on campus, like, not even the big names. You know, I don't even think that you mentioned, like, $400,000 for Rajon Tucker. Like, I don't even think it would cost that for a lot of these guys. Like, the kid at Creighton, Cramshell, right? The reason he's going pro is because he's 24 years old. He's had two knee surgeries, and he's already got his degree. He's probably going to end up going overseas and you know, not making all that much money, at least comparatively. And, like, even if he makes, like, $100,000, what do you think it would take to convince him to go back to Creighton, go back to where all of his friends are, go back to being the big man on campus, go back to being in a town where they're, you know, they fill out a 17,000-seat arena every single night that they play, where you're the biggest thing in that entire city just because you play for the Creighton Blue Jays? You could probably get them for, like, what, like $40,000? It wouldn't even be all that much money. And I think that there's enough floating around there to be able to get those kids paid that amount. So for me, it's just, it's a matter of keeping names on the floor and names on these rosters that people are going to know so that they can have a connection with these teams, so that college basketball just doesn't turn into a sport where it is only the gambling that happens in March that people care about.
How much do you think it would cost to get your baby to stop screaming?
Oh, man. How much do you think I would pay to get my baby to stop screaming? A lot.
I didn't know if you knew that it was seeping through pretty strong.
Oh, no, I know.
Like, it's loud and clear.
She is very she's just like her mom. She's a Jersey girl that is very opinionated and not afraid to make her feelings known. So, yes, I'm very aware of this. And you know what? You hear it through the door and, like, through the microphone, GP. Just imagine when that baby, you're holding her and she's right there in your ear. I can't hear out of my right ear at this point.
Oh, I know. Mine are a little older now. They're past the random screaming sessions, but still, they'll have their moments, all of them, except for the 16-year-old. The 16-year-old's awesome. He's settled in pretty nicely, but the 5-year-old's still a maniac, and the 2-year-old still will start crying for no reason sometimes. But they're all good.
What has been I mean, obviously, we're off topic here, and we always end up talking about dad stuff whenever you're on this pod. So let me ask you this. What has been the most baffling meltdown that you've experienced as a dad so far?
Well, the ones you get on the planes are just impossible, because it could be rooted in something real, like the baby's ears hurt or something, but you feel really helpless there because there's nothing you can do and there's nowhere you can go. And you feel like you're bothering everybody, which you probably are, no fault of your own. And I think most people, particularly folks who travel regularly, understand, like, nobody feels worse on a plane when a baby is screaming than the parent of the baby who is screaming. It is really unnecessary to try to make them feel worse about the situation. They already feel terribly. But nothing comes to mind, you know, in terms of, like, nonsensical triggered breakdowns, except for, like, they're just normal. Like, this morning, how about this? I start out every night sleeping in my bed. And my little dudes start out every night sleeping in their bed. But at some point, they wake up and climb into our bed, at which point I wake up and go upstairs. We move in the middle of the night every night. They will not stay in their room. They want to be with the mother. And then it becomes four people in a bed. And even though it's a king-size bed, it just gets I can't deal with it. So I get up and I go upstairs. Well, this morning at, like, 6 a.m., my little dude is down. I can hear him, like, in the dining room area. He's clearly up. And he's screaming, crying, screaming. And I know exactly what it is. He can't find his mother. And what I assumed, because my wife has been in this 5:30 a.m. class at the gym, I assumed that she must have got up, left, and he woke up, couldn't find her, and freaked out. So I needed to go downstairs. He's up. I got to go downstairs and take care of him now. Well, I go downstairs, and when I look out the window, my wife's car is still here. So I'm like, what in the world? So I pick him up, and I'm like, calm down. But, you know, I get him calm, and I walk in the bedroom. And my wife's in bed. She was just covered up with sheets, and he couldn't see her. He didn't, so he thought she was gone. So he's flipping out. So there it is, 6 in the morning. There's absolutely no reason to be flipped out. But my 2-year-old woke up, didn't see his mom because she was covered up with a sheet. And now the whole we've been up since 6 a.m., all of us, the whole house.
Yeah, I've run into that situation a couple of times. My son is we get, you can hear him, like, the way that our house is set up, you can hear his door open and his door slam shut. And then you can hear his feet pitter-patter down the hallway. And then he just comes barreling into our room. Like, he doesn't quite understand how to fully, like, pull the handle down when you open the door. He just kind of hits it and slaps at it until it opens up and then turns around and slams it shut. So we're all awake, and this happens every night, sometime between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, waking everybody up. So I got to carry him back to bed and explain to him, like, listen, you need to learn how to sleep in your bed. At some point, you're going to have to be here by yourself. And so, yes, I very much hear you on that and the lack of sleep that you get with 3-year-olds running around. The other thing that he did a couple days ago, he has have you seen the movie Sing? Have you seen that?
I have not seen Sing.
It's a really good movie. The songs are somewhat addicting. They're going to get stuck in your head, so I would not recommend actually watching it. But we dressed up as characters from that movie for Halloween, and ever since we did that, he was Johnny Gorilla, and ever since he dressed up as Johnny Gorilla, every morning if he sees that Johnny Gorilla shirt that he wore for Halloween, he'll have an absolute breakdown if he can't wear that Johnny Gorilla shirt when he goes to school.
And oh, well, yeah, we've done that, like stuff like that. Like, my 5-year-old played baseball. He plays baseball. And one game this year, I had to meet him straight from radio, so I wasn't there to get him dressed. He shows up to the baseball game because, when you're a mother and you're suddenly dealing with 3 kids, one's a 16-year-old who's just being difficult because he's 16, and then the 5-year-old, you got to get him ready for baseball, and the 2-year-old, like, also wants to get ready for bait. Like, it's just, I understand. My wife is willing to do anything she has to do to make sure everybody's in the car and on the way to the baseball field. Well, I meet him there, and he's wearing a Spider-Man mask with his baseball uniform. And I said, all right, buddy, you gotta, it's almost game time. You got to take your Spider-Man mask off. No. What do you mean, no? No, I'm not taking the Spider-Man mask off. Well, yet you cannot play baseball in a Spider-Man mask. That's ridiculous. Like, you've never seen anybody do that before. You have to take the Spider-Man mask off. No, like, there's no reason where you should be having this argument, but he just refuses. So then I take the Spider-Man mask off of him, and he starts crying uncontrollably and refuses to move. And remember, like, he won't, like, he's just standing, in the parking lot at the baseball field. Won't move. Game's getting ready to start. He won't move. Now, what are you supposed to do? If you like grab him and say, come on, let's go, then you're that wacko parent being abusive to your kid. So in short of that, you're trying to just talk him into it, but he's not listening at all. And so I'm in this thing took 20 minutes to get him calmed down and onto the baseball field sans Spider-Man mask. Like, what are we doing? Why is this even a thing? But that was that's something that happened 2 months ago.
You should have just let him play with the Spider-Man mask on.
In hindsight, probably, it would have made for a cute little Instagram video, but like, the idea that me saying you can't play baseball in a Spider-Man mask causes all this is just crazy, except every parent of a young person listening has had 7 stories just like that.
So this is the last one that I'll give, and then we'll let you tell me what I need to learn about this Memphis team. So about a year and a half ago, we have friends that live down the street that have, like, they have the backyard that everyone kind of congregates in, right? Like, they have the playground set up and the perfect, like, entrance out from their basement, and it's like the center for all the kids in the neighborhood, so everyone kind of hangs out in that backyard. And when we were in the midst of potty training my son, the first time that he ever had to go to the bathroom there, we didn't have a diaper on him, and we were just kind of like, all right, look, just go, pull your pants down, go right there in the grass. and you're good to go. Like, we'll call it. We'll forget about it. This will never happen again. We'll just pretend that no one saw you go pee on the grass over there. Well, now, anytime that he goes over there and he has to go to the bathroom and he's not allowed to go pee on the grass, he absolutely loses his mind. And it gets to the point where I just kind of let him go. Doesn't matter how many people are over there. And so they had their daughter's christening, I guess. And when we were over there with my son, with like all of this kid's family over there, like parents, grandparents, everybody, probably like 35 people standing in that backyard. And I look over at my son and he's just standing in the middle. He's got his pants around his ankles, his shirt up at his chin with his belly stuck out so he can pee without getting it on the grass, without getting it onto his pants and his underwear. And yeah, that was fun to have to claim that child that was peeing in the middle of the yard in front of everybody at a party to celebrate a christening.
No, I mean, that's the deal. I mean, kids are hilarious and also maddening, and often both of those things at the exact same time.
At the exact same time. All right, so in your preseason top 25, you have Memphis, what, sixth?
Seventh,
correct. Sixth. I have them 19th, and Memphis fans have spent the last week telling me on Twitter how dumb I am, and I'm going to let you have a chance to tell me how dumb I am for ranking Memphis where I'm ranking them, and then I'm going to give you my argument to see if it makes any sense and holds water, because I know that you are what? You're the king of ranking teams, right?
I am. I'm the only one committed to doing it every morning during the basketball season. I don't know if that makes me the king, but it makes me something. It makes me experienced. And so I guess I'd say this. I wouldn't say it's dumb. I mean, you could put Memphis wherever you want, and it's possible that we'll look up in March and go, well, you know, 19th is about where they ended up. So looks like he was more right than wrong. But I will say, based on the way people typically rank basketball teams, it is hard to rationalize having Memphis outside of the top 10. I guess I'd start with the Superbook at Westgate in Vegas updated its odds earlier this week. I'm sure you saw it. Michigan State's now the favorite. Kentucky and Duke have the second and third best odds, and Memphis is tied for fourth in the entire country in terms of odds to win the 2020 national championship.
What are they at now?
They're at 12-1, which is the fourth best odds in the country, right, tied with Kansas. So according to the Westgate Superbook, take it for what it's worth, but they would have Memphis as high as number 4 and no lower than number 5. So based on that, I have Memphis low at 6, and you have them way low at 19. But beyond that, I would say this. If you look at the past, you know, as you know, Memphis has the number 1 recruiting class in America.
Do they really? I had no idea.
That features the number 1 prospect in America. And if you look at the past 10 schools that enrolled the number 1 recruiting class in America, yes, all 10 was either Kentucky or Duke, coached by Hall of Famers, and that is important to note, or at least worth noting. If you look at what they've done, they've almost always been an awesome team, regardless of what they returned. If you just say, hey, they enrolled the number 1 recruiting class in America, what did they do? They've been awesome basically every year. So I'll walk you through it. Class of 2009, that was the John Wall, DeMarcus Cousins class. It enrolled at Kentucky, number 1 class in America. Kentucky got a number 1 seed in the NCAA tournament, finished number 4 at KenPom. Next year, Kentucky also had the number 1 recruiting class in America. That team got a 4 seed in the tournament, finished 7th at KenPom. Next year, it was Kentucky again. That team got a 1 seed in the tournament, finished 1st at KenPom, won the national championship. Next year, also Kentucky. That team went to the NIT with the number 1 recruiting class in America. But remember, the best player on the team, the best prospect in the class, tore his ACL. Otherwise, Kentucky is a top 25 team, not a team that misses the tournament. But either way, that's that. Next year, Kentucky had the number 1 class again. That team got an 8 seed in the tournament, finished 13th at KenPom, though. Next year, Duke enrolled number 1 class in America. That team got a 1 seed in the tournament and won the national championship. The next year, Kentucky enrolled the number 1 team, number 1 class in the country. That team got a 1 seed in the NCAA tournament. Next year, Duke enrolled the number 1 class in America. That team got a 2 seed in the tournament. Next year, Duke again, number 1 class in America. That team got a 2 seed in the tournament. Next year, Duke, number 1 class in America. That team got a number 1 seed in the NCAA tournament. So it breaks down like this. If you go to the top, the last 10 years, the school that enrolled the number one recruiting class in America. That school finished top seven in KenPom seven times, 7 out of 10 years, got a top 2 seed in the NCAA tournament 6 of the past 10 years, got a 4 seed or better in the NCAA tournament 8 of the past 10 years. And when you keep in mind that one of the exceptions to this is the Nerlens Noel team that, you know, lost its best player to injury, if you take that team out of the equation, then it's 7 of 9 finishing the top 7, 6 of 9 got at least a top 2 seed in the tournament, and 8 of 9 got a top 4 seed in the NCAA tournament. And I know what you might be saying, yeah, but what did those schools bring back? The truth is Memphis is bringing back, in terms of experience, not very much, but more than most of those teams. Memphis is returning at least one double-digit score and 3 players that averaged at least 5 points per game last season. Just trust me when I tell you that's more than most of those teams of the past 10 years returned. So again, bottom line, what history shows is if you enroll the number one class in America, odds are you're going to have one of the best teams in the country. It's highlighted by James Wiseman, the recruiting class, but they also have Precious Achiuwa, another 5-star prospect. If you go to Jonathan Givony's mock draft 2020 over at ESPN.com, because it's just another way to chop it up, right now Memphis is the only team in the country that has 2 projected top 10 picks. Wiseman projected to go 1, Achiuwa projected to go number 10. Now, I can't promise you that they're going to go 1 and 10. I have no idea. But just based on that projection, let's go and look at what other teams in the past 10 years with 2 top 10 picks have done. And there's 9 teams. If you'll grant me that Coby White and Nasir Little are both going to be top 10 picks, and obviously Zion and RJ are going to be top 10 picks. So let's include them. I don't need them to make my point, but they enlarge the sample size. If you count those 2 teams, then there's been 9 teams in the last 10 years that have had 2 top 10 picks. And every one of them has been a top 2 seed in the NCAA tournament. 7 of them have been number 1 seeds, 2 of them national champions. And the 2 that weren't number 1 seeds were number 2 seeds. If you want the specifics, it's the 2010 Kentucky with John Wall, DeMarcus Cousins, 2012 Kentucky, Anthony Davis, Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, 2013 Indiana, Victor Oladipo, Cody Zeller, 2014 Kansas, Andrew Wiggins, Joel Embiid, 2015 Duke, Jahlil Okafor, Justice Winslow, 2015 Kentucky, Karl Anthony Towns, Willie Cauley-Stein, 2018 Duke, Bagley, Wendell Carter, then it's 2019 North Carolina, Coby White, Nasir Little, 2019 Duke, Zion Williamson, RJ Barrett. 9 teams, all 9, top 2 seed in the tournament, 7 of the 9, number 1 seed. And so, based on the roster in place, there is nothing that suggests that this team should not be awesome. Now, we can discuss the big elephant in the room, and it's that this team, unlike any of those teams, is being coached by a man who's only been working on a college campus for about 14, 15 months. And if you want to be skeptical of the staff, I think that's perfectly reasonable, I guess. But I will say, if I told you this about a first-year Division I head coach, if I told you the following, forget team, forget name. I just said this to you. I said, Rob, so there's this guy, he'd never coached in college before, but he got a job. And the year before he got the job, the team he took over finished 161st at KenPom. And in his first year, his team finished 56th at KenPom. So improved by about 100 spots. And not just improved by about 100 spots from 1 year to the next, but in the preseason, that team was outside of the top 100. And by the end of the season was inside the top 60. So not only did he improve by about 100 spots year over year, but he improved from November to March by about 50 spots. What would you say about that? You'd say, sounds like that guy did a good coaching job. My point being this, I can't sit here and promise you that Penny Hardaway is Chris Beard or Mike Krzyzewski or some X's and O's genius. I can just tell you, as somebody who has studied all the numbers and watched basically every game, he was not overwhelmed as a Division I head coach. He did not look out of place. He didn't look like somebody who, you know, is going to take elite level talent and you know, make it a bubble team. And so, you know, as always, we'll see. But I guess I would just sort of bottom line it by saying, last year Duke returned less than Memphis returned, also enrolled number 1 recruiting class in America, and they were preseason top 3 according to everybody. If this were anybody other than Memphis and Penny Hardaway, if it were Kentucky and Cal, Duke and K, Roy and UNC, or basically any other established situation, everybody would have him in the top five easy, no question. And the only reason to be skeptical is because it's a different school with a different coach. And so, reasonable minds can disagree, but all the data suggests that the team's going to be awesome. We'll see. They got to go do it.
Well, that's a lot of great data and a lot of great logic and facts and stats, and we'll leave the logic and facts and stats for you nerds over on the Ion College Basketball Podcast. Here on the College Basketball Talk Podcast, we deal in hot takes, and this is my take. So I'm actually not that worried about Penny being a head coach. I think that what you said in terms of his coaching ability is very true, and I think that the way that he's going to get them to play will actually kind of suit the strengths on this roster a little bit. Like, I fully expect them to tell me if I'm wrong here, but to get up and down and shoot a lot of threes and play like an entertaining, fast-paced, open style, and I think that kind of fits what he has on this roster. My concern is the depth of talent. I know that they're bringing players back, but I think that it's different when you are bringing back a starting point guard in like a Tyler Harris versus Duke bringing back, let's just use them as the example, Trey Jones, or Kentucky bringing back an Ashton Hagans, right? I'm worried about the fact that there isn't any kind of veteran presence on this roster other than Isaiah Maurice. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I watched as much Memphis basketball as you did, but I'm not convinced that Isaiah Maurice is going to be able to play the role that like a Quinn Cook did for that 2015 Duke team, or that Darius Miller did for that 2012 Kentucky team. That's why I thought that the addition of Tucker would have been so important for this group, because here you have a guy that's played college basketball for 4 years, has kind of been through it a little bit, that is going to be older than, what, 19, 20 years old. So my concern is, A, the lack of veteran presence on the roster, and B, like I said, kind of the depth of talent, right? Like, I get the feeling that part of the reason this Memphis class is ranked number one is because of the sheer quantity of good prospects that they have, instead of like three or four elite prospects. And I think that there is an important distinction to be made there. Like, I don't want to knock their class, because going out and getting guys like Boogie Ellis and Lester Quinones and like Malcolm Dandridge, like, those are going to be guys that hang around the program for 2 or 3 years and build up some of that roster continuity, where instead of just building a team, Penny is building a basketball program at Memphis. I just don't know if, you know, Boogie Ellis is going to step in and be a guy that can kind of have the impact that you want him to have as a starting player on a team like this Memphis team. So that's kind of where I'm a little bit worried with it. It's the youth and the fact that I think that a lot of these guys and a lot of these freshmen that they have coming in are not going to step in and be the kind of five-star instant impact players that you see at some of these other schools and some of the other examples that you gave. But look, I will fully admit that the ceiling is there for this team. And I already have a Memphis future locked in when they were plus 5,000 that I could get them. So I do understand that they can go out and win a title. I just think that there are more question marks on this roster than the other examples that you gave. And also, like, I don't think that it's wrong to say that this is more of a unique situation than what Duke has or what Kentucky has. You know, we haven't seen this all come together yet. And I don't know if that's me questioning whether or not Penny can get it done. It's just, I kind of want to see it happen before I go saying that they're kind of guaranteed to end up being a top 10 team. So I guess the way that I would bookend it is this: if we set the over under as a 5 seed, or I guess like a 4.5 seed in the NCAA tournament, I would probably end up taking the under on that. I think that they end up being a 5 or a 6 seed this year in the tournament, which is kind of why I have them ranked where I have them. Does that make sense? Is that a crazy take?
No, it's not crazy. It's just I disagree with it, but it's certainly not crazy. I mean, if I were looking for reasons why Memphis would be underachievers, I would start it with, they might start 5 freshmen, and how many teams starting 5 freshmen are really good? And they might start 5 freshmen, but no natural point guard, because Boogie Ellis is super talented, but he's not a natural point guard. So you got somebody who's not a natural point guard, who is largely known as a scorer/shooter, whose responsibility it is to run your basketball team and get everybody involved. Like, that there could be some bumps in the road. And if you want to question the staff, or at the very least say, call me crazy for giving Mike Krzyzewski the benefit of the doubt and John Calipari the benefit of the doubt in ways that I won't give it to Penny Hardaway. Like, I accept all of that. I would just say that you know, Duke didn't return a single player who averaged at least 4 points per game last season. And everybody had him preseason top five. And even as the season unfolded, the non-freshman who scored the most was Marquise Bolden, who averaged 5.3 points per game. So if you want to say, yeah, but Zion's a different animal than anybody at Memphis and Coach K, I totally acknowledge that. But there are plenty of examples of not returning hardly anything of substance in role number one recruiting class and still be really, really good. So when you combine that, and I think this is important too, with the fact that they play in the American Athletic Conference and not the ACC and not the SEC and not the Big 12, I just think once they get into the league, as long as they don't take a beating, and by beating I mean like lose more than two games, three games in the non-league, once they get into that league, they're just going to be more talented at every position, you know, against just about everybody that they play. So even if they aren't, quote, what I think they might be, or Andy Katz thinks they might be, or the Westgate Superbook thinks they might be, their margin for error in league is going to be so vast that they're going to look up and have 28, 29, 30 wins. I really do think, this might sound crazy to you, worst case scenario, I mean, they're going to be way up there and win just because they're not going to be susceptible to losing too much.
Yeah, that's probably fair. I can't see Tulane pulling off that many upsets of Memphis. You don't think Tulane's going to walk into the FedEx Forum and pick them off this year?
Yeah, I don't think they'll lose a home game all year just because they're going to have 18,000. It's going to be an incredible home court advantage and an incredible on court advantage. Like, if you told me they're, yeah, but they'll get caught at Wichita, they'll get caught at Cincinnati, they'll get caught at Houston, however their schedule breaks down, and they'll lose. I think they play Oregon and Portland, and, you know, they got Tennessee and Knoxville. Like, they're going to lose. I'm not sitting here pretending they're going to be undefeated in February, but I think even if they're not as good as they're supposed to be, they're still not going to lose that often. Like, it's just the talent difference is too vast. And so, we'll see. And, you know, if the bar is set, you know, because I've heard some people say this, yeah, I just can't see Memphis winning a national championship. Well, almost nobody's going to, you know, only one team wins a national championship. It's very hard to do. Like, Memphis's odds right now are 12-1. Think about it in these terms. They have the fourth best odds in the entire country to win the national championship, which is pretty amazing. But those odds, the fourth best odds, are still just 12-1. Andy Ruiz was only 11-1 against Anthony Joshua the other night, and that's considered the second biggest upset in heavyweight boxing history. So Memphis has the fourth best odds of anybody in the country, but still is less likely to win a national title than Andy Ruiz was to beat Anthony Joshua. You know, the whole win a national title thing is it's a crazy high bar to set. I think the way I have the conversation usually is, are they going to be good enough to do it? And I think, you know, the roster is going to allow them an opportunity to go achieve basically anything they want to try to achieve.
Well, you're making me feel really good about having them at 50-1 odds to win the national title right now, because some of us savvy bettors like me snuck in there and got them before they landed some of these most recent big names, because you told me that they were going to land those big names. So if I win and this bet ends up hitting, GP, then I guess maybe I owe you a beer.
I'll take two. And yeah, I did not get them at 50-1, but if you did get them at 50-1, no matter what you think of Memphis, having them at 50-1 right now is incredible value.
Yeah. So listen, Memphis fans, we're on the same team here. We're on the same side. I'm rooting for the same thing that you are. So you can stop yelling at me on Twitter now. But GP, listen, man, I appreciate the time. I'm going to let you get back to trying to parent your children and keep them from yelling at you about your wife hiding under the cover. So I appreciate the time, my man. Thank you.
All right, brother. I'll see you.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.